Obama goes to Vietnam, Sumner Redstone goes to court, and we go to Texas for a big affirmative action case down there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 23rd of May. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. A word here as we get going about timing and how really it's everything. President Obama's in Vietnam today, as you've heard, and there is much strategic and diplomatic that comes along with that visit. The lifting of a decades-old ban on arms sales is a great example. Also, though, many things economic. The president is using the trip to push for adoption of his big trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Not to be forgotten as well, $16 billion American dollars worth of business deals between Vietnamese and American companies, including Boeing and GE. Handy, wouldn't you say, that those deals came together just as the White House is making a big diplomatic push? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes it from there.
The president announced that Boeing will sell aircraft to Vietnam, GE Wind will sell wind power, Pratt & Whitney will sell engines. Did all of these deals just coincidentally happen right when the president was landing?
No, it's not purely coincidental.
Robert Shapiro is with economic advisory firm Sonicon and is a former undersecretary of commerce.
But these deals are not made simply for the occasion of the summit.
A lot of U.S. companies at any given time are pursuing deals all over the world, often with the help of the U.S. government. Companies need help navigating a foreign government's bureaucracy, or maybe they're trying to sell to a foreign government. At a minimum, they're usually in touch with the U.S. embassy.
The president then decides he's going to visit Vietnam. What deals are in the works right now that we can announce while the president's there? And that's how it happens.
Often, these presidential visits can speed things up. Miriam Shapiro is with Summit Strategies International and is a former U.S. trade representative.
When there is a presidential visit, it can provide an impetus to help move a deal along more quickly.
After all, it's nice publicity when companies can get their deals done in time to be announced by a U.S. president. Wendy Cutler is vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute.
There are even times when a foreign government will urge its own companies and its own government officials to facilitate deals.
And U.S. presidents do seem to love announcing private sector deals.
These deals generally have to do with exports from the United States, tied and supported by good-paying American jobs.
What president doesn't love that? In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The corporate story of the day, the corporations being Viacom and CBS, come to us in the form of an almost 93-year-old man who is really not happy with some of his underlings. Sumner Redstone, owner of the aforementioned corporations, kicked Viacom CEO and protege Philip Delman off the trust that Redstone set up to run things after his death. Suits and countersuits have been filed, and it is tough, honestly, not to just pull out the popcorn and watch it all unfold. William Cohen's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He has been on the Redstone story for some time now. Bill, it's good to have you on again.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Remind us, would you, who Sumner Redstone is and why this almost 93-year-old man matters in corporate America?
Because Sumner is a kind of media mogul from a bygone era. He's a pretty much a self-made man, and he created a fortune for himself worth around $5 billion, and he controls two very important companies in the media industry, Viacom and CBS. And now, with his advancing age, there's a big fight about what will happen should he die.
How much of what's actually happening here is palace intrigue, and how much is substantive, could affect Viacom and CBS?
I think it's a healthy dollop of both, but it really is substantive because what happens to this trust and who controls this trust will decide what happens to CBS and Viacom after Sumner dies. By the way, there's no requirement that this trust sell either Viacom or CBS. There's probably no compelling reason to sell either company at the moment, especially Viacom, which the stock is down something like 40% in the last year.
Right. So in all honesty, why shouldn't Philippe Delman be fired because stock is down 40%? Why should he be on the trust anyway?
Again, very good questions. I think, Kai, that this is you're seeing play out in real time, virtually almost every day now, what will result in Philippe Delman's departure from Viacom, I would say, in the very near future.
It's worth a mention here that for his age and for the problems he is having, Sumner Redstone was just recently declared mentally competent to handle his own affairs, right?
Yes, this was adjudicated in a Los Angeles courtroom about 2 weeks ago. A former friend and one-time lover of Sumner Redstone's, Manuela Herzer, who was about 50 years younger than Sumner, tried to get him ruled mentally incompetent because he cut her out of his will suddenly. She didn't like that, needless to say, because she lost $70 million as a result. And so she tried to have him declared mentally incompetent. And the judge ruled that, no, actually, he was mentally competent. And the key decision-making element for the judge was that when Sumner testified, he was very explicit about his wishes.
Not lost exactly, but kind of sidelined in this conversation, is Redstone's daughter, Sherry, who stands, I guess, to take over control of the trust and thus of these two companies.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, an important point to point out here is that she was long time estranged from her father, Sumner. He tried about 2 years ago to buy her out of their holding company, National Amusements, for about $1 billion. She turned that down. Theoretically, they have reconciled through all of this, and this will definitely allow her to take control of the trusts and direct the outcome of what happens with Viacom and CBS. And if I could just add one more ironic point, what we're seeing now, Kai, which is absolutely astounding, is that whereas I said Manuela Herzer was arguing that Sumner was incompetent and Philippe Demont, the CEO of Viacom, had argued in the same case that he was competent and the same old Sumner. Now Philippe Demont is arguing that Sumner is incompetent and therefore couldn't make the decision that he made on Friday to take Philippe off the trust.
Les Moonves, the guy who runs CBS, the other big Redstone company, is he just lying low right now saying, I don't want any part of this?
Absolutely, yes. And he is shielded in many ways because he gets along with Sherry Redstone. CBS has performed much better as a company and as a stock in the last few years compared to Viacom, which has sort of fallen out of bed.
Bo Cohen, contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He writes a lot on Sumner Redstone and that whole empire. Bill, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Viacom shares up today, CBS down, the rest of it extremely meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a $48 billion merger deal on the table between the health insurance giants Anthem and Cigna, but all is apparently not well. The Wall Street Journal got its hands on some letters between the two showing some disagreements, including how best to approach antitrust regulators. Could just be a sign of poor communication, you never know, or it could be more, showing deeper cultural differences, always the touchiest point in big mergers. From the help desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more now about the mindset of those mergers.
The cultural fit between companies is so important that Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini mentioned it when he testified about his company's merger with Humana on Capitol Hill last fall.
Mergers and acquisitions are not just about efficiencies and business goals. Both Aetna and Humana share a common culture. Culture trumps strategy.
Anthem CEO Joe Swedish also testified about the merger with Cigna, and both argued their deals could improve care and lower costs. But to pull that off, people and systems must be in sync.
So most mergers actually fail.
Yale School of Management's Amy Resneski says after most mergers, studies show a drop in productivity, and the new companies rarely realize the level of profit predicted. She says trying to stitch together cultures can bring out the worst in people.
Participants in mergers report a lot of hard feelings, a lot of conflict. There tends to be a lot of identity threat around which party to the merger is going to have higher status, which operations and sets of systems will prevail.
Companies could avoid all this heartache, says Bain & Company's Dale Stafford. Before any deal ever gets done, firms should kick each other's cultural tires.
Companies actually don't do a particularly good job of assessing culture, candidly. There is so much focus on the nuts and bolts, on the accounting, on the economics.
But like any relationship, what looks good on paper can be pretty tough in practice. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
If you've ever watched a football or maybe a baseball game online, you might have noticed something a little bit different. Not necessarily about the game. A 3-2 fastball is a 3-2 fastball is a 3-2 fastball. I'm talking about the commercial breaks, as in sometimes there are breaks, just no commercials. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
I talked to ESPN, Turner Broadcasting, even some online folks, and they all told me there's a lot going on here. Actually, you know what? Give me a second to get all this squared away. I'll be right back. That is what you hear a lot of time during a TV timeout. So what's going on? Craig McAnch is with Infrared Experience Marketing.
What's happening is this streaming and over-the-top broadcasting. It's not in sync with the way cable and broadcasters are set up from a commercial standpoint.
On cable, some time is allocated to local markets. When there's a break in the game you're watching, ESPN throws to a local commercial. But the internet doesn't have a local market.
If you think about it, I mean, ESPN is a store in a mall, and the mall is the cable carrier. And because it's a fast-changing world, there hasn't been anything that's set up for most of these broadcasts.
A lot of sports broadcasting has to do with rights management, and forever, that was basically just the broadcast. Mickey Wilson is chief marketing officer with Wide Orbit.
Today, a lot of content is being consumed mobily, so those rights are being negotiated separately. So in some cases, ESPN may not have the rights to actually stream it or monetize it.
In other words, ESPN might not have negotiated the rights to stream those commercials the same as it airs on TV. And when that happens, you'll get another taste of this. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Something I'm very enthusiastic about is we're in the world to solve problems.
Good thing they've got some money to do it, huh? The CEO of the Gates Foundation. Straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, equities just kind of hung around today. The Dow Industrials off 8 points, less than a tenth percent, 17,492. The NASDAQ edged down 3 points, also less than a tenth percent, 4,765. The S&P 500 down 4 points, that is two-tenths percent, 2,048. KLX, the leading distributor of aerospace fasteners, reported weaker than expected earnings. Shares dropped 14% today. Saudi Arabia, as you might know, wants to get out of the oil business so much. Diversify its economy. General Electric gets $1.5 billion in contracts for non-oil projects in the kingdom. GE off a tenth percent today. Monsanto shares sprouted 4.4% today after Bayer AG. Yes, I'm using Bayer, not Bayer. Offered to buy the seed maker for $62 billion. The buyer, by the way, Bayer? Down 5.7%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a bit more than a month left in the Supreme Court's term, give or take. And on the list of decisions yet to be announced is a closely watched affirmative action case called Fisher versus the University of Texas, in which the consideration of race in admissions to UT's flagship campus in Austin is at issue. But that case is about just one part of the state's diversity programs. Under Texas law, students are in the top 10% of their high school class are guaranteed admission to any public university in the state, except for UT Austin, where that has been cut down to the top 7%. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
Every Wednesday, the teachers and staff at Lanier High School wear college T-shirts and sweatshirts to work. And because this is Austin, there's a lot of burnt orange for the University of Texas.
All you see is the teachers, the staff, they're all just wearing their orange shirts. So it's like, oh, that's like the school to go in.
Janet Aviles is a senior at Lanier.
It just makes you wonder, like, oh, what if I went there? Like, I could become like one of them too, like a role model.
The top 10% rule was designed to increase access to the state's top public universities. Most of the kids at Lanier come from low-income families and speak English as a second language.
Walter, where's your pass?
Principal Ryan Hopkins says without the rule, his students would be at a disadvantage competing with students from wealthier high schools.
I'm looking at about 20 kids, which are guaranteed entrance into some of the most phenomenally funded research institutions in the world.
But Janet Aviles won't be one of them. Several years ago, UT Austin was so overwhelmed with top 10% students, it was allowed to cap automatic admissions at 75% of the incoming class. That means for next school year, only students who made the top 7% of their class were guaranteed admission. Janet just missed the cutoff, and when she applied for one of the few remaining slots, she didn't get in.
It is very hard if you're not in that top 7%, unless you have done extraordinary things and can present a kind of a unique portfolio to the admissions office, it's very hard to get in.
That's one reason a lot of Texans have mixed feelings about the law. Many talented kids don't make the cut, especially in the highest performing schools. That's led some families to game the system by moving their kids to lower achieving schools where they have a better chance. Hopkins says the rule also creates a hyper-competitive environment where students are so focused on boosting their GPAs with honors courses, they may miss out on interesting electives or activities.
While we want to promote the most rigorous academic courses, we also want them to be well-developed and to be exposed to many things while they're in high school. This percentage rule kind of puts pressure against that.
But the biggest threat to the law may come from the University of Texas itself. Earlier this year, the system chancellor, William McRaven, asked state legislators to reconsider the policy. Here he is testifying before the Texas House Higher Education Committee.
Your flagship, your number one university in the state of Texas, is ranked 52nd on the U.S. News and World Report. 52nd. To me, that's unacceptable.
McRaven argued that UT Austin's low ranking stems partly from what's still confusingly known as the top 10% rule, because even with the 75% cap, the university has little flexibility to pick its own students with high test scores or other accomplishments. He also questioned how effective the law has been.
We need to go back and look at the facts in terms of whether or not the 10% rule has served Texas in the way that we hoped it would in terms of increasing diversity.
The top 10% rule was created 20 years ago after a federal appeals court ruled that the University of Texas could not consider an applicant's race as a factor in admissions decisions. Because Texas high schools tend to be segregated by race and ethnicity, admitting the top 10% of every class gave an automatic boost to African American and Latino students.
I think it's an ingenious way of creating racial and ethnic diversity.
That's Richard Kahlenberg with the Century Foundation, a think tank. He says UT Austin eventually started considering race again for those students not admitted automatically after a 2003 Supreme Court ruling allowed some race-based affirmative action. That's the policy now being challenged in the Fisher case.
But we know that the vast majority of African American and Latino students who get into UT Austin do so through the top 10% plan rather than through the use of race in admissions.
And once enrolled at UT, those students traditionally have done as well as or better than students from Texas high schools who got in without making the top 10. So how diverse is UT Austin now? Last year, about 4% of undergraduates identified as African American or Black, the same percentage as 20 years ago under affirmative action. Hispanic and Latino students make up 22%, up from 14.5%, though researchers have pointed out that's largely due to population growth.
We also know that UT Austin is much more socioeconomically diverse than it would have been without the top 10% plan.
The outcome of the Fisher case could change that equation. The compromise that allowed UT Austin to cap the number of students admitted automatically came with a caveat. If the Supreme Court were to rule against UT's use of race in admissions, the 75% cap would be lifted. And analysts say that could open the whole policy up for debate once again. Meanwhile, Janet Aviles, the senior at Lanier High School who dreamed of going to UT, has moved on.
I wish I could have gone there, but I guess things happen and you just have to keep working to become what you want to become in the future.
She'll start at Texas State University in San Marcos in the fall. In Austin, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Here's a not terrible problem to have. 40 billion dollars with which to do good in the world. Good as your bosses see it, it should be said. Sue Desmond-Hellman is the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the biggest by a long shot charitable foundation in the known universe. She's been in the job about 2 years, and today is out with her first letter to the general public entitled, What If? It's a very big picture look at what she and the foundation are thinking. Sue Desmond-Hellman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You are the guardian, the keeper, if you will, of a big pile of money that comes from Bill and Melinda Gates. They are active in this foundation. What is your role day to day?
Well, day to day, my role is a leadership role as CEO. And the visionaries are Bill, Melinda, and Warren Buffett.
Because he's going to give all his money or most of his money to the foundation when he goes. That's exactly right.
So they have established that generosity of spirit, the overriding vision that all lives have equal value comes from them. As CEO, I'm thinking every day about how to translate that generosity and that vision into impact.
I want to run a phrase by you here. We talk a lot about, and in fact, just the last couple of weeks on the program, we've been talking a lot about the bigs, big pharma, big tobacco, big cars, big auto. The Gates Foundation is the biggest of big philanthropy. How do you think philanthropy in this country is viewed today?
Well, Americans have always felt good about generosity. Philanthropy in the U.S. has also always been looked on as asking about what's behind the potential black box. So I do think increasingly as there's more philanthropy, more wealth, and therefore more opportunities for philanthropy, we're hearing more questions about influence, more questions about is big philanthropy good philanthropy? I don't think we'll be able to achieve our ambitions on equity if we have any dents in our reputation. That is an essential guidepost for me, and Bill, Melinda, and Warren share in that and act accordingly.
What is the thing that Gates does worst, right? Where do you need the biggest improvement?
I think that the biggest improvement I'd love to see is how we balance our sense of urgency with the knowledge of the value of time. When you hear that 2.6 million babies in the world die before their 30th birthday, you get mad and you want to get on it and you want to fix it right away. What I'd love for us to have a better sense than we do is how to combine that sense of urgency with the appropriate pace. Bill's been quoted as saying that people overestimate what they can achieve in 1 year and underestimate what they can achieve in a decade. And working with others on getting that right is something I'd love for us to be better at.
There was a line in your letter, kind of buried deep on page 4 or 5 out of a 12-page thing. You wrote, in order to make markets work for the poor, the Gates Foundation takes on financial risk that the private sector can't or won't. You guys have an influence, have an impact on the private market. And it looks like you're not afraid to say so.
No, in fact, I want the talent, commitment, passion, and power of the private sector to be part of that quest to solving things like malaria, HIV, TB, a lot of these very hard problems. We know particular issues suffer from what we call a market failure. There's not a private company in the world that when they're talking to their investors say, wow, this is how we will make our P&L look good. So can we use our capital to stack the deck in favor of companies wanting to work on the issues that we work on with a charitable intent?
Sue Desmond-Hellman is the CEO of the Gates Foundation. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can read Sue Desmond-Hellman's letter at our website. It's marketplace.org. And you can hear more from her on our Corner Office podcast. Subscribe wherever you like. We are there. New episodes every other Tuesday. This final note on the way out today, a chance to get a special something for that friend of yours who's a huge fan of Mad Men. Lionsgate, the studio that produced the show, is auctioning off a bunch of old props. You can get, just for instance, the banker's box that Peggy used when she finally left Sterling Cooper. You can get Don Draper's Ray-Bans, or if you are feeling particularly flush, you can get the 1964 Chrysler Imperial convertible that John Hamm, as Don Draper, obviously drove in season 4. It's red. It's quite spiffy. There is some cool stuff. We've got the link on our website. But let's remember, people, it was all make-believe, especially that last episode. Don't even get me started on that one. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 8 points today, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ down 3 points, also less than a tenth percent. The S&P 500 gave up 4 points. That is 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.